Hey everybody, welcome to another episode of the podcast. I'm your host, Brian Keane, online fitness coach, nutritionist, and three-time best-selling author, here to help you by deconstructing expert guests on all things health, fitness, and mindset. Today's guest is with registered dietitian Carolyn Williams on anti-inflammatory diets. This conversation, well, just to give a little bit of a brief background, will probably sound slightly different for the first 5 minutes to the last 40 minutes because Riverside FM, where I normally record my podcast, for some reason just stopped working 5 minutes into the conversation, so we had to go to Zoom. So there might be a little bit of a sound discrepancy, but hopefully in post-production you won't even notice it. But just in case you're wondering why it might sound slightly different, that's why. Today's podcast, we talk about everything that you would need to know about low-grade chronic inflammation, the symptoms, what to watch out for, yellow and red flags, what foods to include and what foods to avoid for an anti-inflammatory diet, how inflammation affects weight loss, the main lifestyle irritants for inflammation, the connection between all your hormones, food intolerances, and the link with chronic inflammation, alongside stress management and sleep tools that you could potentially use to reduce that alongside your nutrition and diet. So a lot in today's episode, and hopefully you get loads of value from it. It was a really enjoyable conversation with Carolyn. So without further ado, here is today's podcast with anti-inflammatory diet expert Carolyn Williams, PhD, on how inflammation affects weight loss, lifestyle irritants to avoid, and the best foods to include. Enjoy. Hey everybody, welcome to another episode of the podcast. I'm delighted to be joined today with my guest, registered dietitian, Carolyn Williams. Carolyn, PhD, is a leading culinary nutrition expert and the 2017 James Beard Journalism Award winner who's developed a knack for breaking down complex science into quick, reader-friendly tips. She's the author of two cookbooks, Meals That Heal, 100 plus everyday anti-inflammatory recipes in 30 minutes or less, and her new book, Meals That Heal One Pot, 100 plus recipes for your stovetop, sheet pan, instant pot, and air fryer, reducing inflammation for whole body health. She also co-hosts the Happy Eating podcast and is a sought-after speaker on anti-inflammatory eating and managing chronic inflammation through lifestyle. I'm looking forward to talking all things anti-inflammatory food, nutrition, and diets in today's episode. Carolyn, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Brian. I'm thrilled to be here.
Yeah, me too. I'm really looking forward to diving into this because, as I mentioned right before we went on air, I actually haven't really covered anti-inflammatory diets and nutrition. I've touched on it in solo episodes with previous guests, but we've never actually done a deep dive on this. And this is your baby in terms of what you cover in books, on Instagram, on social media. So I want to kind of dive into it. But before we do that, talk to us about what got you interested in anti-inflammatory diets originally. Where was that kind of seed coming from in terms of where it grew from?
Yeah, well, you may see it all over, you know, my work, my articles, my Instagram, but inflammation was not even on my radar 5 to 6 years ago. I mean, I knew I would probably write another cookbook because my first job was in publishing, but I thought it would be more focused on weight loss specific, that type of thing. And if you told me I would have written now two cookbooks on anti-inflammatory eating, I would have said, no way. You know, you got the wrong person. And then I may have even gone a step farther and said, like, that'll never sell. So how I got here, you know, the first time inflammation really popped up on my radar was when I was writing an article for Cooking Light magazine on Alzheimer's. And I'm going to date myself here a little, but when I was in undergrad getting my nutrition degree, we didn't talk about the connection between diet and brain health. You know, it just wasn't something even in the textbooks. So anytime I write an article, I just have to do a deep dive into the research and feel 110% confident I know what I'm talking about. And then that always helps too later when it's published online and if you have any trolls, you know, kind of water off your back if you feel confident in your knowledge. So I did a deep dive, and one of the things I discovered with Alzheimer's is there is definitely a diet connection, but one of the key connections to diet is chronic inflammation that kind of drives the progression and development of those amyloid plaques and tangles that are characteristic of Alzheimer's. And that article was actually what I won the James Beard for. And I wish I could say from there on out it was inflammation, but it was not. So I just went on about my weeks, writing different articles, you know, there's always a market for different aspects on weight loss. Intermittent fasting was getting really big then, so I was writing a lot on that, but also some on high blood pressure, autoimmune conditions, you know, all these different topics. And when I finally like took a vacation and sat down and stopped being busy for a second, I really remember having a light bulb moment. And it was like, oh my gosh, as I kind of look back on what I'd written, all these health conditions and all this advice I was giving on these different topics that all felt very different. I thought there is one underlying thread that connects every single one of these, and that is low-grade chronic inflammation. If it is not the cause, it is a key driver. And I went back to all the different research studies that I'd pulled for these different articles, and it's in the research. It is a driver, if not a cause, of every single thing, you know, all of our chronic diseases. But also, I don't think people realize even just little things, you know, thyroid health, hormone health, weight management and weight loss, you know, it plays a role in all of these.
Carolyn, what is low-grade chronic inflammation for anyone that's unfamiliar with it? Where this is their first time, they might be familiar with inflammation, they've heard it, but talk to us about what actually is low-grade chronic inflammation. Yeah. And then we can kind of go from there.
So inflammation, as it was designed, is a good thing for the body. It was designed to heal the body, to keep the body healthy. So for example, you get a paper cut and your finger, it hurts and it's red and it's, you know, maybe a little swollen. Well, that's a good sign of inflammation. That's the red, white blood cells rushing in, other compounds rushing in to heal it. And the key is that swelling, that redness, that pain goes away. Same for like a sprained ankle. It hurts, it swells, you know, and then it slowly goes away. Or you have a fever. That fever's there because to fight off the pathogen in the body, it's a form of inflammation. So that's how it was designed. But the key part of that is it was designed to go away. The type of inflammation that we're talking about today is a newer form, or I guess you might call it the modern form of inflammation, because we really didn't have it 100 years ago. This is a low-grade type of inflammation that's triggered by lifestyle irritants. So things in your diet can play a big role, but also inactivity, lack of sleep, not managing stress well, of course, like smoking, that kind of stuff. Any of those lifestyle irritants can trigger low-grade subtle inflammation in the body. And the problem is that doesn't go away unless you make some specific changes. And what that does is having a little low-grade inflammation, you know, initially it's kind of like having a small fire in your body. And the problem is once you have one little small inflammatory fire, it kind of turns your body a little more hypersensitive. So it's easier for other fires to start. And before you know it, you have systemic inflammation. And inflammation really is, this low-grade inflammation is the driving force behind, you know, pretty much every health condition.
With low-grade inflammation, then let's unpack it through nutrition. Now we can evolve as we go along, because you mentioned all the lifestyle irritants there. With nutrition, with some of the misconceptions and myths that you see around it, is it that people think they have to remove certain foods, add in certain foods? It's only one or the other. And talk to us about what approach you think people need to take, and maybe some of the myths and misconceptions that people have in terms of what they do, but they probably shouldn't, or else they're doing half of it when they're actually missing a whole other half of the puzzle.
Yeah, I'm so glad you asked that, because the first question I almost always get from people is, okay, what do I need to cut out? What do I need to get rid of? And my response is usually not what they expect, because I'm like, okay, hold on. Let's talk about what you need to add. Because yes, you're probably getting too many inflammatory things, but I guarantee you, you're not getting enough of the anti-inflammatory compounds and nutrients. And there is so much power in those. So I really focus on getting people to focus on those anti-inflammatory foods, three groups in particular. And then, you know, what they find is just adding those three groups, it naturally cleans up their diet a little. And so then we can focus, okay, let's look at what we may need to minimize or decrease. And those three foods, when I was going through all the research, there were just kind of three categories of food that just kept rising up to the top. It almost got to be obnoxious. I was like, give me something else, you know, besides these three. But the first one is leafy greens. So any kind of leafy green, obviously, usually the darker, the more nutrients, phytochemicals it has. But just get a cup of leafy greens a day. Aim for a cup a day. And this doesn't have to mean eating a salad. You know, you can incorporate them, you know, a variety of ways. On a sandwich, you can stir them into like a hot saucy dish or spaghetti sauce. You can stir them into soup, that kind of thing. The second group of foods are berries. Fresh or frozen, it doesn't matter. Just get 2 to 3 cups in a week. And then the third group of foods are cruciferous vegetables. And I like to joke that if the vegetable stinks while it's cooking, it's usually a cruciferous vegetable. So your broccoli, your cauliflower, your Brussels sprouts, your kale, those foods that have those sulfur compounds in them that stink a little when you cook them. But it's those sulfur compounds that make them so powerful in the body. And, you know, I guarantee you very few people are getting enough of those three things. And cruciferous, you want to try to aim for 4 to 5 times a week. So just focusing on those first. And, you know, sometimes depending on where people at, you know, I'll just say, focus on one of these. Let's focus on one of these. Get it, you know, get the hang of it. Then let's add another. And what you find is adding these foods and getting into the habit of eating these foods and these amounts on a weekly basis really automatically cleans up the diet a little on its own. And so, you know, there's less to, it feels less restrictive or less, you know, that you're truly cutting out stuff when we go to the other side of the coin and look at, okay, what's probably a key inflamer in your diet that we could reduce some or minimize?
What would be some of the common examples of foods that people should consider minimizing when it comes to inflammation in the body?
Pretty much, if it doesn't occur naturally in nature, it could potentially be an inflammatory component. So a lot of your processed foods, your heavily processed foods. So, you know, certain additives, dyes, colorings, preservatives, you know, different toxins that we get from plastics and in our food supply, you know, so your processed oils, anything with artificial colors or flavorings, artificial sweeteners can be one. Not getting enough omega-3 fats, we get a ton of omega-6, which yes, omega-6 are healthy, but we get very little omega-3 in our diet. Most people don't get near enough each day. And so that ratio is askew. And so not getting enough omega-3s throws that ratio out. And so, you know, getting more omega-3s, I will say, you know, excess carbs, excess calories, excess alcohol, excess added sugar, you know, and I like to be real upfront. Like, I'm going to eat added sugars again. I'm going to have dessert again, you know, many times in my lifespan. And I love a glass of red wine. So I'm not saying you cut it out, but, you know, and actually alcohol can be a little anti-inflammatory at first, but it's just going beyond that with the added sugars, the carbs, the calories, on an ongoing regular basis where, you know, you're just exceeding that moderation, and it's exceeding that moderation that actually leads then to inflammation.
Yeah, I think when it comes to inflammation and food choices, the danger is definitely in the dose. And as you said, and I love your approach, Carolyn, that it's not just avoid these foods and never eat them again. It's like, be mindful that these foods can be quite inflammatory. And if you have too much of them, you're potentially going to have a whole host of problems. And that removing foods, but coming at it from a what can you add in? Because automatically when you're adding in other foods, you would minimize the potential high anti-inflammatory or pro-inflammatory foods that you're eating. So I love that approach. Talk about cooking, because I know you've got your couple of cookbooks. And I'm not going to unpack the recipes in there. I think for anyone that wants to check them out, by all means, I'll link them in the description. You can check them out. But cooking and overcooking and undercooking foods, because you mentioned cruciferous veg, you mentioned plants. What's your thoughts when it comes to overcooking certain foods when it comes to removing some of the nutrients? Just because obviously, when we're trying to eating all those plants, you don't want to be losing the nutrients and the phytonutrients, et cetera, that are in it. It's probably the reason that you're eating it. So what are some of the things people should consider when it comes to the cooking of those foods?
Yeah. So typically, the more you cook a plant food, like a vegetable, the greater the nutrient loss. So, you know, I'm in the South and like take green beans down here. You know, people like to cook them way down. So they are like soggy. They don't even resemble a, you know, crisp or, you know, soft, crisp green bean. So you really don't want to go to that point. But at the same time, you want it to be palatable and you want something that you enjoy. So, and there are some vegetables like cruciferous that actually need to be cooked a little to fully release the compounds in them. So people tend to get hung up on, you know, do I need to eat it raw? Do I need to eat it cooked? That kind of stuff. Just get them in. That's our main problem. You know, just get them in. We're just not getting enough.
Outside of nutrition, then, what do you find in terms of lifestyle irritants is the next thing that has the biggest effect? Is it sleep or is it something else? You mentioned a few in the examples, but what would you have layered on top of nutrition and diet?
Oh, it's a big tie. I think, you know, sleep has really become my primary, my top health habit, even before nutrition, because if I, you know, I know if I don't get enough sleep, then I'm not going to make the best food choices. I'm not going to have the workout that I would have if I'd gotten a good night's sleep. I may even skip my workout. I'm not going to be able to manage stress on a daily basis as well. So, you know, it really all starts with sleep. And I think people feel like sometimes sleep is indulgent, but we can't do anything without sleep. Now, another, I will have to say, I had some extended stress going on this past year, and I really had to have just like a sit down with myself earlier this spring, because I could tell, you know, it doesn't matter how healthy I was eating or that I was sticking to my workouts, but that ongoing stress, and it was stuff out of my control, but you know, it was just really hard to get under control. And I started to tell, you know, it was causing an inflammatory effect that I could tell was really, you know, I was about to see in my physical health. So I really had to address that personally in my health this spring. But for on a day-to-day basis, sleep, you got to have sleep.
Carolyn, what would be some of the symptoms that people would have when they've got chronic inflammation? Because I think chronic inflammation is one of those, if you know, you know, if you don't, you don't kind of things. And what would be some of the symptoms that people would potentially have in their kind of their day-to-day symptoms if they're suffering and they're potentially not aware that they've got low-grade chronic inflammation?
Yeah, that's a great question. The problem is it's subtle. And until it slowly builds and you've got a lot of inflammation, and then it's very easy to see. So I'll start with like some of the early yellow flags that like your body's waving a yellow flag, you know, and I'll say, you know, if you consider yourself healthy right now or pretty healthy, inflammation is going to look like anything that's not your norm. So maybe you're having headaches more frequently. Maybe you're having more bloating than usual. Maybe you just can't shed those 5 pounds that you're usually able to when you really focus on your diet and eating and health habits. You know, maybe you're having more brain fog. You can't concentrate as well. Anything that it's things that you would never make a doctor's appointment for, you know, and we just kind of blow off and keep going with our day. But things that if you really ask yourself, they're out of your body's norm and they keep kind of popping up more frequently. So those are kind of your early signs. And, you know, I give the example of you go on vacation and, you know, you don't exercise, you drink alcohol, you don't eat so healthy, that kind of thing. And you come back and, you know, you may kind of have a headache as you get back on your healthy eating, your stomach feels bloated, that kind of stuff. That's those kind of signs, you know, that's your body like, hey, okay, glad you had fun on vacation. Let's get back to it. And if you get back to your healthy habits, you know, the inflammation is going to subside. But if you don't, if you ignore those signs, then it's going to progress. And some of the kind of the red flags that people often don't realize are inflammation is a sign of inflammation are things like a high fasting blood glucose, or even, you know, a fasting blood glucose in pre-diabetes range. Or lipid values that are out of whack. Triglycerides are high, or LDLs high, or HDLs low. If you take medication, maybe your blood pressure is normal or your lipids are normal, but you're taking medication to keep it normal, you have inflammation. You know, pretty much every adult has, in this day and age, in our modern society, every adult has, you can assume every adult has some level of inflammation, but I tell people to think of it as like on a continuum. You know, and you really just want to keep it on the lower end of that continuum. You know, you go on vacation and it ebbs up a little, but then you get back to your healthy habits and it goes back down. And But the problem is, if you don't get back to those healthy habits, or you don't stop and say, this isn't normal for me, then that inflammation can keep progressing higher up on the continuum. You know, you don't just wake up with type 2 diabetes. It's a slow progression. You know, maybe you gain some weight, you're under stress, you know, you're eating more carbs than normal, or not making the best health choices. It's a gradual progression in getting there, and inflammation is behind it all. And, you know, if we try to listen more closely to our body, which I know is hard, we can stop that progression.
When it comes to weight loss, then I think it's really important as a topic for people to understand. I know you've covered this on your Instagram page already, but so it'll be repeating some of what you said before, I'm sure. But understanding that for weight loss, and I've talked about this ad nauseum on the podcast of caloric expenditure, but food choices playing a role, macro splits and getting protein at major meals, all of these things can potentially impact weight management, weight loss, body composition change. But high inflammation is one of those things that it doesn't matter how well you're controlling your calories. If your calories are too, even if they're in that deficit, if your inflammation is too high, you're not going to be able to lose weight. Your body is just, it's basically just going to fight on to hold it. Talk to us about how inflammation and chronic low-grade inflammation can impact or has an impact on weight loss from your experience.
Yeah, so inflammation really starts to throw off your hormones. And this includes reproductive hormones, but this also includes thyroid hormones. This also includes your appetite hormones like glucose and insulin, and then cortisol as well. Some low-grade inflammation is going to start causing an imbalance in one of those, depending on what is inflamed, what the issue is going on. But what I have found in my research is if one hormone out of that big group that I just named, if any of those are impacted or become unbalanced, it's going to slowly affect all the other hormones. It's so hard to lose weight if you are insulin resistant or you're making too much insulin. And so, you know, maybe the inflammation starts by affecting your thyroid or maybe your estrogen or, you know, testosterone, but that's slowly going to start to affect your blood glucose management, your insulin, your glucose regulation, and that can play a big role in preventing you from losing weight. And then cortisol, of course, if you're going through a stressful period, stress is going to create inflammation, and then you have high cortisol levels, which essentially kind of makes the body insulin resistant, even if you don't have insulin resistance.
Yeah, inflammation, what you mentioned there for people, it has that domino effect. It's one that gets offset. And then what sometimes people look at hormones in this kind of silo up by itself, as opposed to that they're all potentially interconnected. And if one has an issue from inflammation, it has this domino effect on the others.
Yes. I did a deep dive really into all the hormones last summer just to understand them better. And I was like, oh my goodness, like they're all so interconnected. It doesn't matter if it's in your, has to be your reproductive health or your thyroid health or your, you know, hunger and appetite signals. They are all connected. And so any imbalance in one of them is going to shift the hormones a little in those other areas.
Brilliant. And we've spoken about the nutrition side, the sleep side, all of those things that can potentially help and work for anti-inflammatory benefits for the body. Talk about stress management. I think that's a perfect kind of trifecta. Weirdly that you said about sleep there, because something I changed my mind about in recent years, Carolyn, when I qualified first as a fitness instructor, nutritionist, I was nutrition first, training, and then down here was sleep. And now 10 years later, I've got sleep right up there with nutrition, if not ahead of it. So it's funny that you say that. And I think stress management and stress and managing that is something that's also taking precedent even above training and exercise from my professional standpoint. So just add-on.
That's exactly how I probably would have, what my hierarchy would have been, you know, 10, 20 years ago, eating, exercise, and then I'll deal with stress and sleep, you know.
if even.
Yes. I wasn't too worried about the stress management part, but, you know, stress is an irritant to the body. Just like cigarette smoke, just like, you know, all these artificial compounds in food. And we're going to have stress. Everybody has stress. It's just learning coping mechanisms so that when you experience it, you're better able to adapt and handle it. And, but stress, you know, particularly if it's ongoing or it's recurring, is a huge inflammatory agent in the body. As I mentioned earlier this spring, that I just really had to have a talk with myself, you know, because I could tell it was about to, the inflammation from the stress was about to take an slowly going to have an impact on my physical health. And it didn't matter that I was eating great and I was exercising. I had this stress that was creating inflammation.
In terms of lifestyle stress from your example, yeah?
Yes, yes. Yeah.
Just to clarify for people as well, for stress management, because I'm curious to hear some of the things that you did to get out of that. Stress, although is commutative, it doesn't matter where it's coming from, whether it's exercise or a fight with your partner or from food, it's all commutative. But there are different types of stressors. Acute stressors like exercise, cold exposure, heat exposure can be quite useful for dealing with long-term chronic stress. Yeah. So just to differentiate for people. But I'm curious, what did you do to come out of it in terms of having that conversation with yourself? What are some of your own personal stress management techniques that you used that helped?
Yeah, you know, I really just had to force myself to try to meditate, and even just like 2 to 3 minutes a day. I like to be busy, so it has always been a challenge for me to do that. I started incorporating some different things into my regular workouts. I started incorporating a few bar classes a week, which really just kind of helped almost my focus, almost a little meditative for me, just so I had to focus on these tiny, tiny muscle movements. So focused on that, I scaled back my really high endurance cardio some, because I realized at the state I was in with all this inflammation, I was probably just making more inflammation. So I did more moderate cardio. But the key for me, which really blows my mind, the key for me is I started going to an infrared sauna three times a week.
Big fan.
And oh my gosh, I can't not do it. I mean, my friends or my parents can tell weeks where I haven't been. Yeah, it blew my mind. And I've, you know, been looking in research since then at all the health benefits, but I just thought, I don't know what it is, but I can't not miss it. I need to go at least 2-3 times a week.
Oh, you were preaching to the converter there when it comes to any infrared or even steam sauna. I'm a fan of any heat exposure like that. One of the things I wanted to talk on as well is, and I'm very interested in this, and I have gaps in my knowledge in this area, so I'm really curious to hear your thoughts on it. The link between food intolerances and chronic inflammation in the body. This is something that is one of those so obvious when I hear it and I start to look into it a little bit, but I had completely blissful awareness around it, that the more chronic low-grade inflammation in your body, the more susceptible you potentially are to food intolerances. Can you talk to us a little bit about that?
Yeah. So one of the signs, early signs of inflammation, or even when it's the inflammation is more progressed, is you may start noticing you are more sensitive to certain foods, foods that you've eaten for years that never seem to bother you. You may also find that you're more sensitive to like certain beauty products or, you know, or things in the environment. And remember, I mentioned you have, when you first get that first small inflammatory fire, it makes your body just a little hypersensitive. You know, it's kind of like if you are having a bad day and someone irritated you that morning and you're over it, but then something else happens, it's just a little easier to overreact to that next thing. It's kind of how your body is with a little inflammation. It just makes it easier to overreact. So as inflammation progresses, it is not unusual for people to start feeling like they have new food sensitivities. And it's because of the inflammation. You know, once you tone down that inflammation, calm it down, then I encourage people to maybe try one of those foods, adding it back. And a lot of times you can tolerate it. It's just at the point you're at right then, inflammation's too high. Your body's just, think of it as just hypersensitive to all these, you know, compounds.
You may not have the answer to this, and just because I definitely don't, and I've checked on this as someone that will geek out on food intolerances all day, but have you found from your research and your experience that it's a chicken egg scenario, that food intolerances cause inflammation or inflammation cause food intolerance, or is it a little bit of both?
When your body reacts to food sensitivities, food intolerances, that is an inflammatory reaction. I kind of see food sensitivities, food intolerances as a side effect of inflammation that's going to occur. But, you know, and the more you eat them, the more it's not going to help the inflammation that you have.
Yeah, makes sense. And it's one of those things that I've had countless people over the years, and this tends to come with age, although I don't want to lob people into an age bracket, but I think with more years on this planet, you have more exposure to potential irritants and lifestyle stressors and all these things that can cause inflammation. And the amount of people that get food intolerances in their late 20s, early 30s,
yes.
And the amount of those messages I've got in recent years is unbelievable, but it's down to that inflammatory response and all these other lifestyle irritants that you talked about. And I'm curious with that, this isn't something that gets discussed, and I think it's very important for people to understand it, but why do you think, and this is just your own personal experience or opinion even, why do you think doctors and medical professionals and more people aren't speaking about inflammation and that low-grade chronic inflammation that can be impacting so many people and they're not even aware of it?
You know, this was my very first question to myself after I had that aha moment. You know, I was like, oh my gosh, chronic inflammation is, we need to be following anti-inflammatory diet. That's the solution to maintaining health, to preventing disease. And then I thought, well, I mean, I'm not that smart. Like, why aren't we doing this already? You know, why aren't, and I actually, in my cookbook that's coming out or about to come out, I address that. Like, why isn't your doctor talking about this? And, you know, I think it's a couple of things. I think that it's our Western medical system where we are trained to treat the symptom. Mm-hmm. We are not trained to really, insurance companies like to say they do preventative medicine, but we're treating the symptom and then we're moving on. We're not treating the whole body that like a lot of Western medicine does. And I mean, you can't totally blame the doctor because that's how they're trained. They are trained to look at lab tests, very black and white. You know, okay, this shows that you're in the normal range, you're normal. You know, they aren't trained to say, well, this is in the upper end of the normal range, you know, and to look a little deeper, but we should be. And, you know, I think it just takes people, you know, myself included, just getting to the point where they're just pushed to say, I know something's wrong. I don't care that my labs are coming back normal. Something is not right, to push a little farther. You know, I found a great, she's an internal board certified medicine doctor, but she has a very holistic approach. She did most of her training in South Africa. And I think so she got a little more holistic functional medicine approach. And I love it because she takes traditional medicine but also combines that with functional and more holistic. So, you know, I think more people are asking questions, but also at the same time, like, it's hard to kind of question a doctor, you know, particularly when you have a science background. I think the only reason I felt empowered to do so is I was like, hold on, I've done my research. This doesn't make sense. Let's do this test and this test. But, you know, it's not easy. And there's no insurance reimbursement for a lot of these deeper tests and you know, therapies.
Yeah. And I think what I've tried to cover on this podcast, I think we're doing it brilliantly today, Carolyn, with your expertise and other people who've talked about thyroid function and PCOS, where it's been underserved when it comes to what would be traditional Western medicine. And this isn't I'm not far from tinfoil hat Western medicine. I think it's amazing and you should go to your doctor for a lot of things. But when it comes to the nutrition element, that may not be their strong suit. So if you're feeling frustrated that you're not getting the results and it's coming from something that's an inflammatory response in your body that you could potentially take control of with some lifestyle changes, then having that information, I think, is important. So I just wanted to kind of add that caveat there for people. Carolyn, you've done so much research, work on yourself, work with other people, helping them with the cookbooks, the Instagram page, the podcast. I'm curious if you could go back 10, 15 years ago, is there something that you know now that you wish you knew back then? And they can take it in any direction, just because I know you've been self-educating and traditionally educating yourself in so many different areas. But what's something that you know now that if you had known 10, 15 years ago, it would have been greatly helpful to you?
Oh my goodness. Well, that would take me back to when my kids were 5 and 2. And so from a parent perspective, there is so much I'd do differently, you know, eating included. There's just so much we didn't know, so many things I wasn't taught as a dietitian to question. And I had to have those life years of experience to be like, you know, this isn't set in stone. You know, let's look at that gray area because, you know, something isn't adding up. So, you know, I think I needed those life years to get to the point to push me to be like, you know, what Professor Jones said isn't still right necessarily. But I would have also told the younger me to slow down and focus more on, you know, just I was so focused on just nutrition and fitness. And I just neglected, you know, like the mind body health component. Would have just told myself to slow down and that that was important, even though that may not necessarily burn calories. That was important, you know.
It's so funny how things change as we kind of evolve as well. And sometimes that step back and that stress management. And even as you mentioned, the 2-minute meditation, you would never think maybe 10 years ago, it was like, well, I need to go and walk more, do an aerobics class or burn some calories. And it changes. And again, a lot of that comes with education as well, that all of these things compound positively over time. I'm curious, what's your opinion then with supplements? Because I always think of nutrition, like my supplement philosophy is always, you know, supplement what you're missing in your nutrition, if it's, you know, vitamins, minerals, etc. But obviously, it's context dependent on the person. What are your thoughts then on supplements? Do you think there's a place for them in terms of, straight away I jump to things like adaptogens, things that might potentially help you with stress management, etc. But what are your thoughts? Do you have any that you like or any that you use personally or any that you're potentially a fan of?
Yeah. So I have never been a huge supplement person, but there is one. Vitamin D3 is one I think every single person on the planet needs to be supplementing with. You cannot rely on the sun and your skin making enough. And there's not causative research, but there is a lot of interesting associations between low vitamin D levels and most all of your chronic conditions, autoimmune stuff particularly. They can't say the low vitamin D caused it, but it's some interesting associations. And most everybody, well, the majority of people aren't deficient. They are subclinical. They are not getting near enough of what they need. So D3 is just one across the board I recommend supplementing. Omega-3s, if you don't eat a lot of fish or oily fish, your fattier fish, supplementing with that and making sure you get one, though, that is primarily EPA and DHA. Just those two. You want to see that 99% of the supplement is EPA and DHA. And then magnesium is kind of my new one that I've adopted. Magnesium levels are one too, that because of the processing of our food and soil erosion, there's a lot less in food. And again, most people aren't deficient, but it looks like the majority of the population is maybe subclinical or, you know, not getting near enough of what they need. And magnesium is involved in over 300 different enzyme for different chemical reactions in the body. It's key, and it plays a key role, you know, in muscle contraction, but also mental health, a lot of different things. So magnesium is my other one that I've started supplementing with some too. From adaptogen perspective, I'm a little obsessed with ashwagandha. I'm not good at the key with ashwagandha is you have to take it regularly every day, and you see like the maximum benefits around 60 days. Now, my problem is that regularity. We did a Happy Eating podcast on ashwagandha, and we really could find little to no downsides or contraindications. And just the, you know, there's not a ton of research, but when it came to mental health, like anxiety and depression, it was really impactful. So yeah, I'm looking more into adaptogens, but ashwagandha is one that I know I'm big on.
Yeah, no, I'm a fan of all those supplements. As I said, you have a couple of staples for me there too. I think I'm in Ireland, and anybody in Ireland, UK, certain parts of the States, you need your vitamin D. You're just not going to get enough from your sun. If you're living in California and you're listening to this, you might be okay. But just for 80% of the world, you probably need your vitamin D supplement, and magnesium I'm a big fan of as well. Carolyn, I've really enjoyed this conversation. I think you're doing great work. Really looking forward to seeing how the new book does with the Meals That Heal One Pot. As in, we've touched on just little bits of anti-inflammatory diets in today's podcast when it comes to nutrition, when it comes to lifestyle, when it comes to sleep, stress management, etc. And I'm going to do this in a separate introduction that we had to piece together two different platforms. So I really appreciate your patience when it comes to merging Riverside FM and Zoom together. But for everybody listening, where is the best place for them to connect with you? Is it through Instagram? I'll link your website, obviously, in the books in the show notes for today's episode. But for anyone that wants to reach out for you or pick up the books, where's the best place to do that?
Yeah, so I'm most active on social media on Instagram, and my handle is @realfoodreallife_RD, or you can search my name, Carolyn Williams, and I should pop up. The books, you can buy them at any major retailer in the store or online. Of course, Amazon has it as well, but any of your major retailers, Barnes & Noble, Books A Million, you know, any of those should have it. And my website, you're going to link it in the show notes, but it's CarolynWilliamsRD.com. And I've been so enjoyed talking with you today.
Oh, the pleasure was all mine. I really, really enjoyed this. As I said, I think you're doing great work. And for everybody that's listening, I will link Amazon for the books so you can head on and pick those up. I will link the website, Instagram, Facebook, LinkedIn, and your Linktree. I've got your Linktree here in front of me as well, but it has a link to everything so people can click on through. But Carolyn, keep doing what you're doing. Really enjoy your work and really enjoy this conversation. So thank you so much again.
Thank you. Same here.
There you have it, anti-inflammatory diet expert Caroline Williams on all the things that you need to know when it comes to anti-inflammatory diets. We got through a lot in today's podcast, and hopefully you didn't even notice the sound jump from Riverside to Zoom. So yeah, I need to look at potential alternatives for recording podcasts as Caroline is in Alabama. So probably not going to do a face-to-face podcast anytime soon with Ireland to Alabama. But hopefully you got loads from today's podcast. If you did, be sure to let me know. Take a screenshot, pop it up on your social media, or feel free to tell your family members or friends or anybody you think will benefit from this podcast. That's all from me from this week's episode. Catch you all next Monday.